Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
Our founding fathers gathered in taverns to enjoy lively political conversation over a local brew, and so do we. It's a special Pints and Politics edition of River to River, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio, today coming to you from Theater Cedar Rapids. I'm Ben Kiefer.
And I'm Aaron Jordan.
Well, Aaron, we're together once again with our esteemed panelists at Theater Cedar Rapids. And before you introduce the panel, I wonder if we could call this our political vortex edition of Pints and Politics.
That sounds appropriate.
Is that good?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So our panelists here on the far right, we've got Todd Dorman, Insights and Editorial Editor, Linda Waddington, Gazette Columnist, James Lynch, Gazette Political Reporter, and Adam Sullivan, Gazette Columnist.
Just for the record, Aaron, that's your far right, but I'm on their far right.
Okay, yeah, sorry.
And that's no joke.
All right, well, we're going to get started here with the government shutdown. It ended last Friday after 35 days. For federal workers, that meant two missed paychecks, and more than 300,000 people won't get any back pay. What do you think is the longest lasting effect of the shutdown on the economy?
Probably those missed paychecks, because people were not spending. I think what struck me most about the shutdown was, for if you didn't work for the federal government, a lot of people really didn't feel much impact, which is kind of sad, especially since it was part a bargaining chip. It didn't seem to have much impact out here in flyover country, unless you wanted to apply for your tariff payment, your damage assessment, or whatever you want to call it. You know, it just, for a lot of people, it was business as usual. And so I think it's another example of the federal government, Congress, the presidency, really being out of touch and with the rest of us.
You know, it's just one more thing that's kind of spawned uncertainty. I mean, that's businesses, people who own businesses, run businesses, that's one thing that they, you know, it's difficult for them to deal with, this sort of uncertainty of, you know, if you're going to raise taxes, tell me so that I know and I can deal with it. If you're going to, you know, rescind contracts, if the government's not going to be open, you just don't know how that's going to affect you. So you might pull back on an investment, pull back on an expansion, because you're worried amid all the other things that are uncertain, the trade war, and the healthcare situation, and all the other issues that are sort of hanging out there. It sent the message that once again we've just had this dysfunctional crew running things.
You know, that's a cumulative effect that's been going on for some years now, that uncertainty. One big difference now is that for the next 2 years, we're going to have split government at the federal level. We're going to have a Democrat House and a Republican White House. And as unproductive as they were in the last 2 years with united government, it's going to be much worse. And so this was our first sign of how are they going to work together. And the result was that they're not going to work together.
What does this do to the Democratic agenda? The Democrats have been sworn in with their majority in the House now for several weeks. This shutdown focus has obliterated, has it not, the first few weeks when they could have sort of made their issues felt. Is this just a stutter step to begin? Did it have a real impact? What are we going to see now, at least in the interim, supposing we do get a negotiated end and no new shutdown?
I don't see them unified around certain issues. I think that there's segments of the party, and I think maybe this is a process in which they're coming together on the issues. So I'm not really hopeful that a Democratic House is going to put forth some grand bargain that the Senate might take, or that the White House might accept, because the Republican Senate and the Republican White House don't even agree on anything. And so certainly with immigration as charged as it is, we're several days now into their supposed negotiations, I'm not hearing, parameters of what a big deal might look like. So I'm not very hopeful.
You know, I think it bothers me that the Democrats in the House are kind of being judged by this shutdown, when the shutdown actually began December 21st, before they were even sworn in to Congress. So, If you want to lay blame about who could not come together, who could not create compromise, who could not decide that this was going to get done, I mean, it's a Republican House, it was a Republican Senate, and it was a Republican White House. So I think when you come into a situation, they did the best that they could, given what they had. And Abby Finkenauer was able to move a bill. People were put on committees. Investigations have begun, and that was kind of the basis of what they promised, a lot of them, when they were campaigning. So we'll just have to wait and see. I don't think we can judge them on the first 2-3 weeks on the job.
So I mean, now there's only 2 weeks.
Right.
You know, what do you think is going to be, you know, do you think we're going to get something put together in that period of time, and what might it look like?
It's difficult to say. The president today seemed insistent that it has to be a wall. He's tweeted, "A wall is a wall is a wall," or something to that effect. Last week, they were sort of scolding reporters who insisted that it was a wall, but now they're insisting it's a wall. So I think in the end, I think the president probably realizes that it was a huge political loser the last time, and I think he'll end up settling for something if it's border barriers or some sort of funding for border security. But the wall is always the backdrop, and he's insisting on, and if he continues to insist on it, then things could get ugly because the Democrats are dug in.
It seems to me that there are enough things that that Trump would insist on having in a package that that there are a number of House Democrats, a lot of them are newly elected, have promised that they wouldn't do, or it would be very difficult for Speaker Pelosi to bring them along and the rest of the House leadership. Especially because the terms of this negotiation for the next shutdown really are around immigration, it's really difficult for me to see how we don't have another shutdown. But people are, you know, people in Washington are optimistic, but they always are in these situations, and yet we have shutdowns.
Right. I think it's worth noting that it probably sort of stutter step or took the wind out of the sails of Democrats by changing the subject. Instead of launching, you know, 1,000 investigations of the president's wrongdoings and moving forward with their Democratic agenda, basically all the focus has been on the shutdown and who's to blame for it. So I think it's delayed whatever impact the Democratic majority in the House will have, at least until after the next shutdown.
Yeah.
It's Pints and Politics, a special edition of River to River on Iowa Public Radio at Theater Cedar Rapids with a live audience. My co-host, Aaron Jordan, I'm Ben Kiefer, with columnist Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, Adam Sullivan, and political reporter James Lynch.
Well, I wanted to touch on, I was looking through today's Gazette, and there's a number of articles about what steps Democratic presidential candidates are making in Iowa. Some are visiting, some have rented out office space, others have hired Iowa staff. We've got John Delaney, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, Cory Booker, Kristen Gillibrand, and Elizabeth Warren. Sorry, I just had to look up the pronunciation of that. All those folks have here, of all those people and others of Democrats who have been here to Iowa so far, who do you think is the most interesting? Who do you want to know more about?
There's so many.
I don't know that this person is the most interesting, but I've followed Representative Tulsi Gabbard's last few years pretty closely. Since she got in, she's been very divisive within Democratic politics from what I've seen, but I don't know that I would go in caucus for her. I don't know that I would vote for her in a general election, but I think it's vital that there's somebody in that race that that at least wants to put forth ideas for rethinking American foreign policy, to not have such interventionist foreign policy, because right now on the national stage, there are very, very few people who would question kind of the prevailing paradigm. So I think she's very interesting and worth watching.
This reminds me of those stories that the Gazette sports staff writes about this time of year about next football season. You know,
power.
You know, what does the linebacking core look like for next year? and essentially, that's where we're at. You know, there are 20, 30, 40 people out there who might run, who maybe come and visit Iowa, and test the water here. And I mean, I've been to a number of these events, and it strikes me that Democrats are really hungry for somebody They aren't sure who that is yet, but you know, they'll go cheer for Eric Swalwell, and then they'll go cheer for Elizabeth Warren. They'll, you know, Kirsten Gillibrand. They're going to be there, and they're excited about all of them. I don't know that they've made up, if they've picked a favorite.
Okay, James, you successfully dodged the answer to that question.
You bet. Thank you.
You've been hanging around politicians too long, yeah. James.
What can I say?
Let me put it to you this way. Not names, but qualities. Name the qualities that you think those in Iowa are hungry for in this coming caucus campaign season. What, you know, if you want to do a fill in the blank, the candidate who will be popular in Iowa from in the Democratic column will be?
I hear a lot about electability, that they definitely want to win in November.
And I think from what I'm hearing from Democrats, they're looking for a progressive candidate. They like things like Medicare for All, seems really important, which is kind of interesting because I've read a number of stories and seen some polls that Democrats want a more moderate party. That doesn't seem to be the case here in Iowa from what I'm seeing at these candidate events. It seems like they want a more progressive, more liberal party than what they have right now. Electability, I don't know how you define that, but everybody is talking about electability.
The part that I really enjoy about the caucuses is when they start coming into Iowa and they start setting these calendars, and of course they're going to come into Des Moines, they're going to come into Cedar Rapids, most of them will go into Iowa City. But I want to see who goes to Waverly and who goes to Tipton and who goes to Tiffin, and we're not really at that point in the race yet. A lot of those smaller meetings are private meetings that are happening, but that the media, that they're not inviting me to come sit down with them and watch what they do. The exception being Tulsi Gabbard, who I got invited to sit down with her when she met with veterans and then met with them again in West Branch. But we're not to that point yet where I can kind of say, this person is appealing both urban and rural, and that's kind of where I want to be. But I think broadly, I think they're tired of the hooey. Iowa Democrats are, that they want someone who's governed or has experience governing. They want someone who can appeal, who has that kind of charismatic personality. And I think that's kind of the basis of the agenda right now. We're so early.
I think it's going to be interesting this weekend to watch Senator Sherrod Brown, who's coming and he's doing the small events. He's going to Clear Lake, he's going to Perry, Cresco, small towns like Waterloo and Dubuque, but he's skipping Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, Davenport, the big cities. And that's his strategy is he wants to go to those places that were where Obama voters were, and then they voted for Trump in 2016, and trying to bring his Ohio populism to those areas and see if it, if anybody is interested.
Changing gears a little bit, U.S. Senator Joni Ernst's divorce proceedings became public last week, disclosing details about domestic assault allegations from both sides. She also told Bloomberg that she had been sexually assaulted in college. How, if at all, do these disclosures affect Senator Ernst?
Well, you know, I wrote a column, how this manifests is completely up to Joni Ernst. It's up to her. It's not up to us. You know, we talked before about Brett Kavanaugh and what happened with those nominations, and we all, or most of us, I think, basically agreed that she was treated very badly because certain people thought she should have reacted a certain way or behaved a certain way, or that should have made her such and such type of person. I don't think we have the right now to look at Joni Ernst and say, because you went through this, you should be thus and such type of person. It's up to her. Okay.
I think also that just from a cynical political perspective, the timing of this works in her favor, in that, you know, in another year, 2 years, this is going to be old news when she's, you know, actually running for re-election. So in a way, it's good to have it out there now. I know reaction from some of my fellow Statehouse reporters was, gee, this is going to make her more formidable because she's more likable, more relatable. I don't think she let the affidavit out to further her political career, but I don't think it damages her politically.
In addition to Joni Ernst, another Iowan member of Congress that made national news recently, Representative Steve King publicly addressing Iowans for the first time since his controversial New York Times quote on white nationals and white supremacy. His comment, just to quote it verbatim, white nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization, how did that language become offensive? He said that the backlash against this was about the left policing our language. And you mentioned Judge Kavanaugh. He compared the backlash against what he said to the inquisition that the Justice Kavanaugh faced during the Judiciary Committee hearings. He said, I made more than one mistake. We all have, King said. I should have never done an interview with the New York Times.
You know, before we get into this, I have to know, when he starts talking about the Inquisition, does anybody else see, like, the History of the World, part one, where they're doing the dance?
Exactly.
So what is his position now in the Republican Party, and where does he stand in 2020, now that he has, what, at least two primary challengers, right?
Three, yeah.
And he's been stripped of his assignments, correct?
Right, so, you know, because he lost his committee assignments, he's totally useless, but he's been totally useless there. He has been totally useless for his whole career there. He's never really enacted legislation. You know, our Dave Loebsack, our other congressman who's been there for some time, isn't known for passing a lot of legislation either, but even he's enacted more bills than Steve King has. And so on a practical level, I don't think it makes much difference, but the optics of it are bad. The idea that he's sitting there, he doesn't have committee meetings to go to, he's not making any difference. So I think it remains to be seen, but I think it has an impact.
And as far as his primary, I think he's up to three or four opponents now, you know, which works to his, in his advantage. You know, the more people in this primary, the better his chances are of winning. There are a lot of Republican players who are getting behind Senator Randy Feenstra as a primary challenger, but as these other folks get into the race, it muddies the water. And you know, you remember Steve King got the nomination when nobody won the primary and it went to convention, and he came out of the convention with the nomination. And you know, the same sort of thing could happen if we get too many people in that race. You know, it's going to be hard to beat Steve King in a Republican primary. And if Randy Feenstra, for example, wins the primary, it's going to be very hard for a Democrat to beat a Republican in that district. I mean, that's just, the numbers make it very, very hard.
I would, the people that it would need to take to get rid of Steve King would be kind of rank and file Republican primary goers, right? And those are kind of the last people in the world I would expect to go to a protest. You know, people that they don't identify their whole life based on the Republican Party, but they go to primaries. Maybe they're a little bit more moderate. Those are the people that would decide this primary. And so they're not going to show up to protest. If there had been resistance here, I probably would have chalked that up to independents or people on the left that would have been out protesting him. So I'm not surprised. You know, he certainly has a lot of supporters that'll come out in bad weather, even, as Linda pointed out. I don't know that necessarily reflects on the general primary-going population.
Well, and his re-election performance was weak enough that, I mean, if you're a party leader in Iowa, if you're a Kim Reynolds, you might have noticed that you outperformed him heavily in that district. So why do you need to continue to, you know, stand next to him on stages and sort of be asked uncomfortably about what he says if he's not really providing any benefit or any voters?
But would that be the same Kim Reynolds that had him as a co-chair?
Well,
on
exactly.
Campaign? Yeah.
Well, maybe that. But it, maybe now we're going to see Republicans not embrace him so much because he doesn't bring him as much to the
right.
table.
He's not as valuable to Kim Reynolds or to Chuck Grassley or to Joni Ernst as he was a few years ago. And so that's why they're not, you know, rushing to his defense. They're saying, you know, he needs to do a better job of representing his district. And I think, you know, they look at it and they say maybe Randy Feenstra will turn out more Republican voters than Steve King will or whoever gets the nomination in that district. I mean, it's a heavily Republican district. I don't think J.D. Scholten came so close because Republicans switched sides so much as a lot of them probably didn't vote. I mean, they voted for Kim Reynolds, but they didn't vote for Steve King. So, you know, practically speaking, if you're a Republican running on a statewide ticket, you want somebody in the 4th District that's going to turn out people for you as well as for themselves.
I just want to clarify what I'm hearing, and y'all tell me if I'm correct or not correct, that it was okay that Steve King is a racist. And we'll have him as a co-chair for our campaigns, knowing that he is a racist and that he advocates for white supremacy. But if he can't get butts to the voting booth, we're going to kick him to the curb.
It's a numbers game.
There's cold calculation in politics.
Yes.
I'm explaining, not condoning. So let's be clear.
It just kind of makes me a little bit ill to think that that's now the standard, is who can drive people to the polls and not people who are good people.
Well, we're watching an entire Republican Party being held hostage by Donald Trump, who is also not a good guy, but yet they stand with him. So these are the ugly calculations that are being made, and that's
my party, right or wrong, you know.
Well, I mean, yeah, now it's,
I mean, not, that's nothing new in politics,
now more than
really,
ever, I guess.
But you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, on that note of James telling Linda she's absolutely right, I wanted to ask
thanks, James,
about the State of the Union address, which is this coming Tuesday night. What do you think are going to be some of the highlights? Is this going to be one of President Trump's speeches where he's very focused and he gets all of his talking points, or is it going to be a little bit different?
You know, I would have thought it would have been focused, but given recent events, I have no idea. I just can't imagine him being focused and presidential, or House Democrats being whatever you call congressional, I guess.
Are you sure this isn't going to be the pivot? I mean, we've been waiting for the pivot.
I'm waiting.
To presidential.
I'm waiting.
Maybe.
I think the best thing will be the gifts of Nancy Pelosi rolling her eyes over his shoulder.
Yeah. That's right. They're always in the background, aren't
they?
That's right. The Speaker of the House. And the majority leader of the Senate, right? So we get to watch them do whatever they do for 40, 50, 60, 90 minutes. Who knows?
It doesn't need to be that way. It could, you know, it used to be a 20 or 30 minute thing. It does not, we don't have to do this, people.
They used to just submit it in writing. I think that would be.
And there's been an invitation to women to wear white for the State of the Union address.
Suffrage.
Yes, to represent suffrage.
Yeah.
Well, we want to take a break here. It's a special edition of River to River, Pints and Politics from Theater Cedar Rapids before a live audience. We're calling it our Political Vortex edition because so many have come out amidst all the snow and the cold, frigid weather to talk politics over a pint. When we come back, we'll ask our panelists, James Lynch, Adam Sullivan, Todd Dorman, and Linda Waddington, about some Iowa legislature news. How about that, Aaron? A resolution last year to add the right to bear arms to the Iowa Constitution. What else? The judicial nomination process being thought about. Mental health care, restoring felon voting rights, just a few of them. Perhaps we'll touch on those and others. And certainly, we want to get to all the questions that our audience has, as many as we can. Aaron Jordan, with me, Ben Kiefer. We're pleased to be here at Theater Cedar Rapids for this edition of Pints of Politics.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
Welcome back to this special edition of River to River, Pints and Politics at Theater Cedar Rapids with my co-host Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. I'm Ben Kiefer. On our panel, political reporter James Lynch, along with columnists Todd Dorman, Linda Waddington, and Adam Sullivan of the Gazette. Let's welcome them back. Aaron and I are calling this our Political Vortex edition. What is it? Because you might think we just made up that term. No. What is a political vortex? Well, it's when a very cold mass of swirling Washington politics dips uncharacteristically into the Midwest, resulting in biting political commentary from our panelists. I guess it's only going to last a couple of days, so we better take advantage of it.
What do you got for us?
I want to start off with an audience question here. So the legislative session has started, and I believe we have a couple of bills on this, but where does Iowa stand on medical and recreational marijuana, and is there talk of relaxing policies in the current law we have right now? This is from Joe.
Yes. There are some bills on that. There are probably a number of bills that would address medicinal marijuana, cannabidiol, but raising the percentage of THC so that it has more impact, can be used for more conditions. In fact, there was just a tour the other day where a lot of legislators went to MedFarm to tour what they're doing there. So,
which that's the manufacturing facility
right,
in Des Moines.
Right. So there's a lot of sort of low-level work being done on that issue. Nothing has really popped at this point, but I think that's one of the things that in the Senate there seems to be more support than in the House, but I wouldn't rule out some movement on that this year. It's early, so it's safe to say that, I guess. But there is work being done on it. There are people interested in expanding the law.
Are there any of those proposals that are supported by Linda Upmeyer?
That's the big question. Linda Upmeyer's position is she wants to get the recommendations from this advisory board before taking any action. The problem is that by the time they get the advisory board's opinion, I think they'll be adjourned. So it'll take until next year. And a lot of people want to move faster on it, that they think there's enough information and evidence to go.
Are we on an arc toward recreational use of marijuana? Adam says no, but I'm going to just throw this out there, Adam, before you answer here. I remember, what was it, the 80s, when gambling was thought of in Iowa, and when gambling was first mentioned, and it became riverboat gambling initially, Iowa would become a Sodom and Gomorrah type of state, right? And now this state depends on those revenues, and we can't get enough of the casinos. We only worry about that there's too much saturation in the market. So are we heading inevitably toward recreational marijuana and the state getting its bit of revenue?
Are you speaking personally or as a state?
It's certainly an inevitability. I mean, it's already an inevitability. People in every state and city in America smoke marijuana and consume illegal drugs. So it's already an inevitability that people use it recreationally. Certainly, it will be legal in Iowa at some point. I think that's more like 10 years than 5 years, though. I think first that we would have to decriminalize it. And so there's been bills the last few years, actually, sponsored by Republicans that would make marijuana a simple misdemeanor instead of a serious misdemeanor. That's really important because it's less penalties, but also it would give municipal governments the ability to make possession of marijuana a municipal infraction. And so, in you know, those loonies down in Iowa City can make it a $5 ticket, and then if, you know, in Kyron, Iowa, if they still want to, you know, threaten people with a 6-month jail sentence, they could still do that. And so, first we need local control. I don't think it'll happen this year. There's a chance. You know, it does. Brad Zahn, he's a senator from Urbandale, a Republican. He's a committee chairman. He's been a big proponent of it. I definitely think it could get past the Senate. It's hard for me to see that getting taken up in the House, though.
If we could make recreational marijuana a byproduct of ethanol production, I think somehow then you'd line up the right kind of support.
A cover crop.
Yeah, a cover crop. Exactly. I mean, you got water quality, you've got life quality, I guess, maybe. It's
on that note, for real, though, there's hemp, the possibility to legalize hemp, which is actually a cover crop. I guess there are some properties that, you know, for runoff, preventing runoff and absorbing toxins and stuff like that. I would say that has a good chance. James would probably know better.
Well, yeah, and I think that illustrates also sort of the difficulty faced by people who want to expand medicinal use of marijuana or recreational use, is that, you know, the guy who is sponsoring legalizing industrial hemp, introduced that bill about 20, 25 years ago, and we still don't, you know, growing hemp is still illegal in Iowa. He's more optimistic this year. And he said there are a lot of farmers out there who would be interested in doing that. So I think, you know, it's very incremental, like a lot of these things, like gambling and a lot of other things, it's incremental. But, you know, it probably, when 49 other states have recreational marijuana, Iowa might.
And if you
can only smoke it on the floor of the casino.
Right. If casinos want it, then...
You know, I also want to say that we now have a business interest in Iowa in medical marijuana, and we don't have a program that allows very many people to access that, which are going to harm those businesses. And we know if anything can move the Iowa legislature is a business interest, so there is hope that there will be something coming out of this legislative session.
Erin Jordan, we want to get to some more of these questions here. What do you have?
Yeah, well, another question from the audience. What do you think is the future of Medicaid in Iowa? We privatized it a couple of years ago now. How do we make it work better for both patients and providers?
That's been one I've been a little bit surprised. It was certainly an election issue that people were upset about. It kept bringing it up, obviously, for good reasons. At least what's trickled down to me, I haven't heard a bunch of movement that, at least on the legislative level, that they're planning to take action. Governor Reynolds met with the Gazette editorial board this week, and, she again acknowledged that the rollout has been bad, but she was optimistic about the future. She said they've hired some new people and they have some new processes. But I don't hear about it nearly as much as I did in November. And some of that is just, when elections are going on, you do hear about stuff. But for the Republicans who ran for re-election saying that they would go to the legislature and look at some kind of response, I haven't seen anything, although maybe my colleagues have.
I think people are still looking for some leadership from the governor and from the Department of Human Services. I haven't heard a lot of discussion since this session started about specific changes. There certainly are lawmakers who want to see some changes. But as big an issue as this was in the election, Kim Reynolds won re-election. So I think that has sort of tamped it down in terms of how much impact it's going to have. I don't know. I mean, it just seems like the people who deal with this every day, the providers, people who are relying on Medicaid, I can't imagine they're going to give up trying to get paid and trying to get services and those sorts of things. So we may not have heard the last of this.
Gretchen of Marion is in our audience, and she approached me in the break to have a question about something that's been in the news this week, actually been several weeks since our midterm elections. But this week, Republicans in the Iowa House of Representatives voted not to count 29 mail-in ballots in this Northeast Iowa State House race. It was a party line vote that approved a report saying that the Iowa House does not have the legal authority to open and count the ballots. And this upheld the Republican incumbent, Representative Michael Bergen, who won by 9 votes over the Democratic challenger in House District 55. Gretchen of Marion asks about, we need some clarification. This seemed to become about a disagreement over the definition of intelligent mail barcodes. Why were these disallowed? Why were these voters would certainly say they've been disenfranchised here as voters? 29 votes.
You know, I think the main thing to come out of this is that voters now realize that if you vote in Linn County, if you vote in Johnson County, if you vote in Bremer County, where you vote depends on whether or not your vote will actually be counted, especially if you're doing absentee voting, especially depending on how the U.S. Postal Service processes those. So, I don't know what the future holds here. I've heard there may be some more court action on this specific case, but I think all voters in Iowa are very well positioned now to say, we don't like these rules, that your geography depends on whether or not your vote's counted. And I hope that's the message that everyone is sending to their lawmakers, is that this needs to be a consistent process. So if this is counted here, it needs to be counted here, it needs to be counted there, and this inconsistently just cannot stand, because everyone who cast a legally counted vote should have it counted, or a legally cast vote.
The outcome really isn't surprising. I mean, the history of these contested elections is that the party, the majority party, seats its candidate. What I find really interesting, though, is the people who say, like, well, there's no problem with the law. The law is clear. We don't need to change the law. And it's like, well, if the law was clear, we wouldn't have this contested election. And I think I don't see a lot of movement right now in the legislature to change the law, but it needs to be changed so that, as Linda said, a vote is a vote is a vote, regardless of what county you cast it in.
Right, because in this election, if you weren't aware, the same types of ballots were counted in Fayette County.
Yeah.
But not counted in Winnesheek.
And we only know about this because it was so close and because there was, you know, a well-organized campaign to address it. But there's counties may not be counting these votes that come in without what that county auditor's office assesses to be the correct markings. And also people, if you mail in your ballot, how many of you have mailed in a ballot and then called the auditor's office a couple days later to say, hey, did you want to make sure you get my ballot? No, and so there's ballots that don't get counted. And so absolutely the law needs to be uniform. But I don't think this is a policy issue, but as individuals, I would really encourage you to cast your ballot in person if you can. You know, don't risk your life to do it, you know, if it you wait till election day and it's snowy or something like that, but thank you for risking your lives to come here and be with us tonight. But cast your ballot in person. I think there should be opportunities to vote. I think that's great for people who need to do that, but whether it's at satellite voting early at your auditor's office or on election day at your polling place, that's the safest way to vote is to put it in the machine yourself and make sure that that counter ticks up for your vote.
Well, this episode has identified a problem with the voting system. I mean, people's votes aren't being counted, which is obviously a problem if we have a law that leads to
depends on who they vote for
disenfranchised. But, you know, we move heaven and earth to try to address voter impersonation, which isn't really a problem. It's not a real problem. It almost never happens. So we do that. We spend lots of money, but then we have an actual problem demonstrated by this election, and we're going to be like, well, do we really need to do anything about that? I mean, it's so whenever you hear folks talk about every vote counts and we've got to protect the integrity of the vote, they don't really believe that. They want to protect the integrity of their votes, not somebody else's, and that's not how you run a democracy or a democratic republic so that no one calls and says, we're not a democracy, which I get. I get those emails. So.
You know, one of the letters that we received at the Gazette that really touched me here, that we got too late and we couldn't actually publish, was from a couple outside of Postville, Iowa. And her husband was disabled, and they have voted absentee because, you know, that what's worked for them. They actually live in a community called Frankville. And they no longer have a polling place in their community, so they would have to travel elsewhere. So it's all of these things. This couple, both of them, are two of those 29 ballots that were not counted. And, you know, I'm very upset that we got the letter too late and that we can't actually run it, because these are two people that were actually impacted by that, and that's their story, and that's why they do it. It isn't for convenience, necessarily. You know, it's because that this is what works for them, and they want to be a part of the process. And I think it's shameful that they aren't.
If you've just joined us, Pints and Politics on River to River, it's a recorded live broadcast from Theater Cedar Rapids in, of course, Cedar Rapids with my co-host, Aaron Jordan. I deliver the facts and only the facts. Aaron Jordan, my co-host, political reporter James Lynch, columnist Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and Adam Sullivan, of course, all of the Gazette. Good trivia quick for our audience here. Who is, as of this week, third in line in succession to the president? Shout it out.
Chuck Grassley
is right. He was voted in president pro tem of the U.S. Senate. Dovetailing that to his previous connection with the Senate Judiciary Committee, of which he is no longer the chair, let's talk about the state judicial nomination process as part of what's happening here. Now, the Governor Reynolds, raising the possibility that we may change our judicial nomination process for our highest court. What's behind that? Has that gained any traction?
Judicial activism. And which, depending on, you know, your point of view, I guess there's too much of it or not enough. But yeah, the Republicans in the legislature have talked about changing this judicial nominating process. Although not all Republicans are on board with that. Some of them think the present system is working just fine, that there's no problem, and there are things that the legislature needs to address that don't involve the nominating process. So, however, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee is one of those who thinks it needs to be changed because of there's too much judicial activism, which I understand to mean that he doesn't agree with what the decisions the justices are making. Nobody seems to be complaining about legislative activism. They pass a lot of laws every year, they don't like it when the judges make decisions. So I don't know where this is going to go, because leaders, some of them are on board, some of them seem to be lukewarm to the idea. And like I said, there are a number of Republicans who don't think there's any problem and don't think there's a need to change anything. So this may be one of those things that gets talked about at elections, but not in between.
And there's the Judicial Nominating Commission. You've got 8 lawyers elected by the bar and 8 Republicans now appointed by Kim Reynolds, and they want to get rid of the 8 lawyers and make it all gubernatorial appointees. And so there'll be 16 Republicans, presumably, and that will make the system fairer. At least that's the argument.
I haven't seen a proposal. I haven't necessarily heard anyone say they just want to make it all gubernatorial appointments. Although
that was the bill that was filed
right.
last year.
As far as leadership this year, I haven't heard anyone put that forth. The leaders have said, and what the governor said to us the other day is basically, they make kind of vague statements about, you know, the process doesn't work, but I, you know, there's no one, no prominent person that I've seen put together, a plan of what that would look like or how they would achieve that. If anything, I think this is an opportunity for the supporters of the current system to educate people about it, because I don't think people know what's going on or who the people that vote are or why. There's not very many places in state government where a special class of licensed people votes, for a very important state board. And so to educate people on why that's the case, I think it's a good opportunity. But that would be a major deal, right? But they didn't put out a plan during the election of what that might look like. They haven't in the first couple weeks of the legislature. And so what I would be really worried about is that there's some major, major change gets presented and then pushed through really quickly. I think that would be a mistake. I think this is the kind of thing we need to slow down and have a conversation about.
I think if the legislature decides that lawyers don't have any business on the Judicial Nominating Commission, they should make sure there aren't any farmers on the Agriculture Committee.
I think the comparison would be if only farmers voted for some of the members, right?
But the farmers. I mean, it's not only the lawyers who are voting for.
When this was created in 1962, the politician would get to pick some members of the commission, and then lawyers would get to pick the others, so that it wasn't all picked by a politician, because they were trying to remove politics from the judicial system, which before that, judges were elected, nominated by parties. There were even gentlemen's agreements where both parties nominated the same judge for one position. So it was I don't want to say corrupt system, but it was a system that wasn't very responsive. So this was created, and I think if you're going to fundamentally alter that system created by constitutional amendment by voters, you need to have a constitutional amendment and put it on the ballot. You don't just go in and tinker with the commission and decide that the governor gets to appoint all these people, because that's mainly the proposal that's been floated. It should go back to the people if we want to change the system.
Let's end this Pints and Politics edition at Theater Cedar Rapids with a quick look toward the future. After 35 days, the government shutdown finally ended late last week when the White House and congressional leaders, they struck a deal to reopen the government through February 15th. The agreement contained no new money for a border wall, but it did call for a bipartisan conference committee to spend the next, 2 weeks left, 3 weeks total, negotiating ways to secure the southern border. Now, my question for the panelists on our way out, with the deadline of February 15th, what's the Valentine's Day gift that would likely encourage the president to accept the deal of the committee? You have a few seconds to think about that, and I have to add this footnote. You may not answer a big, beautiful wall. We all know that would be impossible to wrap.
One thing that the president and I have in common is that we're both big consumers of fast food, so I say we get a couple McChickens and light some candles and talk the whole thing through.
So you may remember that Steve King came before the House with his little demonstration walls, his little model walls. I think we could go plate those and send those over to the White House so Trump can have his wall.
I mean, you know, what do you get for the man who has everything, you know, right? But I think the best way to get him to sign the agreement is to send Mitch McConnell over dressed as a Cupid, and he can deliver a singing telegram. Can you imagine Mitch McConnell singing, first of all? And that would be good. Good stuff.
Ben, I know you said we couldn't say a big, beautiful wall. You said it would be too hard to rap. But I remember the artist Christo. He could wrap the wall in a lovely shade of pink and deliver it to the president.
That would be very nice.
Thanks to our panelists, and finally to Todd for giving us, in conclusion, that image of Mitch McConnell as a Cupid.
You're welcome.
We have to go home with that image, Todd. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Todd.
Pints in Politics was recorded yesterday evening at Theater Cedar Rapids. My co-host was Gazette reporter Aaron Jordan. Our panelists, Adam Sullivan, Linda Waddington, James Lynch, and Todd Dorman of the Gazette. By the way, the next Pints in Politics event is March 21st. Find out how you can attend by going to thegazette.com. Our producer and audio editor today, Emily Woodbury. Sound engineer, Jim Davies. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.